The year this week's album debuted was full of wonder and joy. No, I'm not kidding. One of the biggest debates was about how to actually pronounce the year we were entering into, with horologists, the study of calendars for those who are wondering, divided into two camps about how to correctly say it. Ultimately, the informal group won out, and the reign of terror imposed upon us by the formal group in the early 2000s mercifully ended. WikiLeaks became a household name, and Picasso's nude, green leaves, and bust sold at auction for more than $106 million. Oh, and Spain won the World Cup right as Instagram launched. I mean, it's a pretty big year. Today's artist is a man whose most popular song was born out of an argument with his wife and encapsulates perfectly the beauty of marriage and the ties that bind. The year is 2010, not 2010 for you weirdos out there, and the artist is Andrew Peterson. The album, Counting Stars, today on Two Dudes and Tunes. Welcome to Two Dudes and Tunes, the show about the music that made us who we are. My name is Wood, and I'm joined as always by my good friend Chris Robinson. Chris, do you think the high-end art market is just a front for money laundering? I looked up the Picasso painting from the intro, and it sure doesn't seem like a $106 million investment.
Well, you're asking the wrong guy, because I don't have an art education degree by which to judge said painting. So I look at it and go, looks nice. Sure do like it. But I also don't have $106 million to chuck at a painting. So I'm the wrong guy to ask.
I've been watching a lot of Netflix documentaries about famous art heists and how different art was moved and used for currency recently. And I think I've just about bought into the conspiracy theory that art is just a way to move money that otherwise would not be movable.
I mean, I'm not going to put much of anything past people with more money than sense. So if nude,
green leaves and bust.
if that's your equivalent of a $100 bill, maybe
$106 million bill.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. You might, more money, more problems. Yep, you might have more problems than sense.
Awesome, man. Well, what's new with you this week?
Man, not a whole lot. I've been really into watching Westerns. I watched The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and High Noon this week. And I feel bad. You know, this is not a movie podcast. It's a music podcast. But I just haven't been really digging into any new artists. Mm-hmm. I've just been kind of listening to the same old, listening to this stuff for this podcast. But what about you? What's new in your world?
Well, while we're on the topic of Western movies, you and I had kind of chatted a little bit back in the past about Westerns, and I recently rewatched one of my all-time favorite off-the-common-path Westerns, and that's Open Range with Robert Duvall and Kevin Costner from like 2003 or 4. So if you haven't watched that one recently, give it a check out. It's pretty great.
It is on my list of to watch movies. My dad actually was talking about that movie on Sunday. We were just talking about Westerns and he brought it up.
It has one of the greatest gunfights I have ever seen. Like,
ooh,
it's a phenomenal movie and it's so startling. I won't give it away. I want you to watch it. And then I want you to come back and talk to me about it.
Yeah, I want to watch it. I'll have to watch it next week.
Nice. Anything else new?
Oh, you know what? I did forget. I wrote in here. So Megan and I finally closed on our house. That's kind of a big thing. And just a peek behind the curtain for the listeners, we're doing two episodes today, recording two of them. And I had that in the notes for the next one, but it doesn't matter because this isn't contemporaneous with anything. So yeah, we closed on our home today. And about a week before that, I had my first kind of interesting homeowner experience.
Tell me about it.
It's so obnoxious, as all homeowner experiences are, I'm sure. But So for some background, my wife and I bought the house that we were renting. The gentleman who was renting it to us, the property was important to him and his wife, and they wanted to sell it to somebody who wasn't going to run it into the ground. And so naturally we were like, hey, well, we like this house. Can we just keep it? Mm-hmm. And so we bought it. And so the washer and dryer unit that are in the laundry room back here, that is also podcast headquarters, Ground Zero. they were his units. We had ours just in storage because we bought some for the place we lived in before this. And so I had to move those out so that the guy buying them could come and pick them up. Mm-hmm. Well, I got the dryer out, no problem, perfectly easy. But I went to get the washer out, and the outlet knobs were super stiff for one thing. But what I noticed was the hot water tap, the plastic knob was completely broken off of it.
Aww.
And so it was after work. I was tired and irritated. So I got the cold water tap shut off and disconnected. Well, I was like, well, I'll just get the hot water off and into a bucket before I turn the tap off, which turned out to be complete idiocy on my part because the water pressure
wrong.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Put it up there. Home one, Chris zero. So I've got all this hot water like spraying out of this like half opened connection between the hose and the washer. And so I like tried to like crank the hose back on and got that stopped. But I had to get a pair of like my dad's old multi-tool was the only pair of pliers I had around. So I had to death grip this faucet. This like knob and like pull and crank it, and I couldn't even get it completely shut off. Mm-hmm. So it's sitting there drizzling into this bucket, and I was super stressed out because like water stuff, I don't like, I'm not a plumber, and if something with plumbing goes wrong and water is going everywhere, like that's bad news. You know, it's the end of the workday, so I doubt there's a plumber that's going to be around. So I had to hop in the car and race as safely and legally as possible to Home Depot to go find like a pair of pliers and like a bunch of other stuff to like get this faucet shut off. And so I came back home and wrestled with it. The other thing that's super annoying, you know, those outlets have a plastic frame that they're mm-hmm. like encased in. Mm-hmm. Well, whenever this area was redone, they didn't bolt it to the drywall. So it's just hanging loose. Mm-hmm. Like it's just sitting in this like ill-fitting hole in the drywall. And so I had to like try and grip that frame with one hand and like crank this stupid faucet shut. And I finally got it turned off and got everything like our washer and dryer hooked up. But it was interesting. I don't like plumbing stuff, I've decided, because water will ruin everything if you don't like take care of it fast enough.
I've been to the Grand Canyon. I've seen the destructive power of water.
Yes, yes, indeed. And we don't need a canyon out here. We just bought this house. We can give it a few years before we start flooding the back room.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, it looks like you've got some music to share. I got to listen to one track by this artist, and I enjoyed it. So why don't you tell us about it?
So this morning I was back at work for the first time in about 2.5 weeks. Last week I made a trip to Dallas, which was mentioned on the podcast, for work. But it was really like a couple of half days to get something done that had to be done with my boss's boss. But I've been off for essentially 20 days since being around. And so my first day back, one of my employees, he and I were kind of calibrating on what was going on. And he was like, oh, I'm going to see this band tomorrow night at Flora's Country Store here in San Antonio, or technically it's in Helotes, but, you know, shout out to all our Helotes listeners, I guess. But anyhow, he was like, you have to check them out. They're really, really great. And it was because I was listening to next week's album in the car when he was in the car with me. And I really dug into it. So the group's name is Shiny Ribs. They're a band out of Austin, Texas, and they've been together since about 2011, it looks like. They've released 9 or 10 different albums, and they're very kind of progressive, outlaw country slash blues slash big band. Like, they've got some brass, they got some stuff going on. It's just a lot of fun. And the lead singer's voice, I don't know his name because I just got into him today, but really cool group, really cool sounding. Highly recommend you check them out. And it's Shiny Ribs, no space, like just Shiny Ribs. So
Shiny Ribs.
It was pretty cool.
So I feel compelled to be kind of irritating and point out that you said 2011 when in your intro you chastised the grammarian police for saying 2010.
Yeah,
instead
I know.
Of 2010.
I'm one of those people who waffles around. I have no stance on anything. I just thought I thought it was funny. I looked up the Wikipedia article for what happened in 2010 or 2010. And the entire first paragraph was this long debate about would it be 2000, like 2001, 2002, and 3, when it had been 1999, 1998. You know, we had done the short form dates for almost 100 years at that point, it seems like. And then in 2000, everything became 2000 and a number. And when 2010 rolled around, everybody was fighting over, well, do we stick with the 2010 or do we go to 2010? It's like, why is that the big debate to lead off the year? Usually on those articles, it's like the USSR collapsed and rained down all this different, you know, strife in the world. Nah, it's
political fallout. I don't know what it is about the 2000s that made people collectively lose their minds, but it really does seem like there's some dumb trivial thing to do with the year, even though we have thousands of years of precedent. Like, did people get to the 1800s and go like, well, what do we do? What do we call it? Is this year of our Lord 18,003 or what? It's just so absurd. Humanity is doomed. We are just doomed.
We get more and more upset about stupider and stupider things too. Like 2010 was the tipping point for a year to be argued about. But whatever.
But
that's not what we're here to talk about tonight. We're here to talk about an album from my list, Andrew Peterson's Counting Stars. Want to get into that?
Yeah, let's do it. All right, Wood, why don't you tell me about Counting Stars by Andrew Peterson? How did this album make it onto your absolute favorites list?
So this one was a fairly late entry onto the list for me, kind of thinking through what were the albums that meant the most to me at some point or another. And I'll be honest, this one had kind of fallen off of my radar. I remember being given this album in about 2010 by some family friends who I know don't listen to the show, but I'll name drop them anyway. It's the Deal family, and they gave me this album in response to a struggle I had been having for a couple of years. Back in a prior life, you know, pre-2012, basically, I worked for a church and was really bought into the church as a place of grace and a place of just, you know, accepting people where they are and finding the best in people. And over the course of about 6.5 years working there, I became more and more disillusioned with kind of that idealistic understanding of what the church is, because I was young and I didn't understand that the church is run by people. It's not necessarily run by Christ. And so without getting,
unfortunately,
it doesn't live up to the ideals in a lot of cases, especially when you're worried about running a business in a certain aspect of it. And, kind of a tipping point for me was in the summer of 2008 or late summer of 2008, when a person who was really, really close to me, somebody that I thought the world of, was an amazing person, was working for the church in an office that adjoined my office there. And so I saw them every day, spent a lot of time hanging out with them, and just thought they were the coolest person ever. They worked in America on a green card that was, you know, their presence in America was only allowed by the fact that they had this job at the church. And one night, while out and about with a bunch of friends, this person made a mistake that the church just kind of decided, nah, we're not going to put up with that. And so this person ended up being fired by the church and then deported. And it was like instantaneous. It was gut wrenching. And I get that we have standards, and I get that there were rules in the HR handbook at the church that you couldn't get arrested for something, or you couldn't, even if you were found innocent, just the mere fact of being slapped in cuffs was enough grounds to get you terminated. And so this person ended up being deported, and I get that those things happen. What really ended up eating at me for about a year and a half until this album was given to me was the way the administration of the church treated that person after the fact. It wasn't that they'd made a mistake. It wasn't that they had done something incredibly stupid that definitely deserved getting fired. They erased this person from the entire history of the church. This person was on the staff, was a very active member of the children's ministry. Their picture was in all sorts of different events, at all these different mission trips, and involved in all these different things. They were all over the church. And the week after they were dismissed, all those pictures came down. Pictures, the same pictures went back up with that person edited out of them. I mean, it was like totally whitewashing them from the history of the church. If somebody asked, what happened to so-and-so? The official answer was, they're no longer a part of this church. And, you know, we wish them the best. And that was it.
Wow.
There was no explanation. There was no grounds. And to this day, there has never has been. And that really just kind of rocked my world to a point that I knew that these were people and they weren't perfect and that things weren't, you know, totally on the up and up with the being like Christ and doing the Christian thing. And I had kind of gotten to a point where I did not have a faith in the goodness of the people who were there. You know, that those decisions were made by a couple of people towards the top of the administration, and it wasn't the feeling of everybody on the staff. But there were about 120 people on staff at that time, and we all went along with it and kind of marched that line. And there was a point when I came to the Deal family in the late summer of 2010 and was just like, I'm not sure I even want to do this Christian thing anymore. Like, these are the people I'm surrounded by. And I was working there 45, 50 hours a week at that point in time. So that was like my only exposure to, you know, the church, if you will, was working on this staff and dealing with this fallout and seeing how they were handling some of the other things that were going on. And thankfully, Tom and Glenda kind of sat me down and were like, well, that's not really what the church is meant to be. And we have this artist who we think you really need to just listen to. And they knew that I was one of those people that you needed to give me a book or something to go wrap my mind around and really struggle with something. And so they gave me this album, which was brand new at the time. It had just come out. In fact, I believe I may still have it in the jewel case. And it was like a pre-release copy. Like, oh, it was at like some event that he'd done and they'd gone to it. But they also gave me all of his other albums, which I believe this is the fifth one that he did. So there were some earlier albums in there too that built into this. And one thing about this album, and I'm sure we'll get to talk about it, is just about every track on the album deals with kind of the existential crisis of faith. Is it worth going on? Is it not worth going on? And I know we're not a Christian podcast, but you and I both happen to be Christians and see eye to eye on that. So this is the first true Christian album we've done. And I think it may be the only one actually on our list, unless I'm wrong, that is marketed to this market.
Yeah.
But this album was one of those things that I could kind of lock myself into a room and think through the lyrics and think through kind of the meditative music that is there. and wrap my mind around a similar struggle that a guy is having, you know, across the country from me, wherever he was at the time, you know, when he produced this. And so that was my initial exposure to it, if you will. And in a way, it really kind of redirected my path and threw me down a road that led me to where I am today, working in the corporate world. And I ended up getting a degree in a totally different field. I changed majors as a result of it all because I thought I was going to be in ministry, and really kind of changed the trajectory of my life without changing the faith that it's based on. And so because of that, I have a lot of strongly held feelings about this album. What was your impression of it? And did you even know who Andrew Peterson was?
So I didn't. I did not know who Andrew Peterson was. I had never heard of his music. And his my initial reaction to his music is that, for the most part, I liked it. I think that his lyrics are kind of the strongest thing about his music. I like his voice for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I got quite a few opportunities to actually listen to this album. It was playing in the car when I was frantically driving to and from Home Depot to try and keep my house from getting flooded. I mean, we can get into it, but I kind of struggle with a lot of Christian music.
Me too. It's pandering in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it panders and like, so just for some background for my like personal faith stuff, I kind of quit doing worship band because I just got tired of the way the music is, you know. So I'll just get into it. I don't want to hog the microphone because this is your album here. But from my perspective, a lot of Christian music is just really passive and just super soft and bland.
And inoffensive. It's doing everything it can to toe step just inside the lines.
Yeah, it's a lot of it feels generated to make people comfortable. Mm-hmm. And consequently, the music just feels really inconsequential.
You know, they could get away with a lot more if they served beer in church instead of coffee.
I know it. You know what? monks used to be brewers of beer. I don't know why that tradition. Are. Yeah, just in Europe, not here in the U.S. But, you know, this album, I think, is different than the kind of music that I'm complaining about. It's similar, but it's different. You know, I got super bored with playing a lot of music by Hillsong and Elevation. A lot of those worship music bands just tend to lean on the same sorts of things. And this album had a little bit of that for me. The production was super glossy. Everything felt compressed to within an inch of its life. It was very, I don't know, just overwrought with like this like really sterile sounding approach.
This is really indicative of the early 2000s Christian recording industry. Mm-hmm. If you look at kind of that, the Christian music world, it's generally about 7 to 10 years behind whatever the mainstream is doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the 90s were a time of just super polished recording in the country and kind of, you know, mass market appeal music. And here we are in, you know, the early 2000s. And we're seeing a lot of that same just across the board in Christian music, period, not just on this album. And I agree, it is almost too polished, it's too sharp in its production value. But go ahead, keep going.
And I mean, I know you will, but feel free to interrupt because I don't want to sit here and hold a cord on one of your episodes. But, you know, the even down to the way some of the melodies are constructed, there's not as many kind of high points and points of tension that I like tend to enjoy in music. There were a lot of moments in this album where I wanted Peterson to really reach for it and to go for like a big exultant high that he just didn't do. And as far as his voice goes, like it didn't seem to me like that was because of his limitations as a musician. And, you know, I can't say for sure what his motivations are. I don't know him. But the craft of the songwriting and the lyrics were really great. And so it kind of baffled me a little bit that some of the melodies were kind of as aimless as they turned out to be. But that's kind of my feelings about it in a nutshell. Obviously, this album has a lot of like lyrical importance to you, right? Like, because this helped you get out of a rut in your faith, which is no small thing.
Well, yeah. And I think when you sit down and just read the lyrics to this, and unfortunately, the version of this album that I had originally did not have liner notes. It was just like a single page photo of the cover art, and there was nothing. That's why I'm pretty sure it was like an early release.
Yeah. Because that's criminal. Yeah. You got to have a liner sheet with the lyrics.
At least you can understand the lyrics when he's singing them.
Oh, yeah, so
it's
absolutely.
It's not a matter of like a couple of weeks ago when we were doing Metallica and you've got to read the liner notes because what just happened?
What? Yeah, this is not Yellow Ledbetter by Pearl Jam. Nobody's yeah, exactly. Like, well, I don't know. We don't know what the lyrics are.
In the Garden of Eden? That's what they're saying? No. But that said, when you go back and read the lyrics on like... you know, musicgenius.com or whatever, your sources, there is a certain poetry and words that stand apart from the music itself. It's almost written like meditations on his faith at the time, or like a daily devotional, if you will. And then he puts that to music. And I think a lot of that has to do with one of the things I wanted to talk about Andrew Peterson since he released this album is he's released a few more albums. They've kind of branched out from this a little bit. His earlier music is indicative of this album, the sound. He kind of went in a little bit of a different direction after this. And then in the mid 20 teens, he started writing a young adult fiction. And so he's won all sorts of awards for a whole series of books that he's written, a four-part like fantasy young adult fiction series that he wrote. But when I listen to the lyrics or read the lyrics here, I feel like he wrote the lyrics first almost as thoughts on whatever he was doing, like journaling, and then he set them to music. And that's one of the reasons that some of the melodies kind of seem a little passive or a little... you know, like they don't really develop because that wasn't the purpose of what he was saying. And I could be totally wrong on that, but it's just the feeling I get, you know, here we are 11 years later talking about it. So that's what I pick up a little bit.
Yeah. You know, it's unless we ask him, we couldn't ever know. Right. But I get the impression that that stuff, for a lot of people, music and lyrics kind of come together and you sort of tease those ideas out. But man, there is a skill with words in this album that I really appreciated. And I had to keep reminding myself of the context of this music because like Christian music, I think a lot of times, you can kind of see where it's written from. Is it written by Christians to proselytize other people? Is it written by Christians for Christians? Mm-hmm. Is it just a believer just writing songs?
Or if it's the Lutheran hymnal, it's just how much doctrine can we cram into this?
Exactly. Can we fit this psalm into a musical cadence?
4/4 time, everybody. Know. Let's go.
Yeah. You could say something about stuffing 5 pounds of stuff into a 3-pound sack, but we won't go there. But
this something, is a Wendy's.
I usually chafe against music that has just like that has doctrine expressed so literally, unless it's, you know, an old hymn that I grew up with where I feel like it's really artfully expressed. But I found with this album, with Counting Stars, that if I allowed myself to say, okay, like, don't listen to this expecting, you know, like the point of view of somebody like Joni Mitchell or, you know, Neil Young or Sufjan Stevens, like, this is a guy writing music about his experience of faith, really, I think, to other people who are having those experiences. I imagine that's why it, you know, spoke to you so strongly and clearly. And so once I was able to say, okay, stop trying to judge this by a metric that it's not trying to fit, mm-hmm. I found that I really liked it.
Don't put this on the Hillsong scale.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you want to get down to it, Hillsong is not exactly operating on a scriptural level, but well, I'll stop talking so we don't have as many emails. But, you know, like, there was a lot of stuff on this that spoke to me in particular in my situation. Fool with a Fancy Guitar is an example of what I like to call a songwriter reading my mail. He opens that song with, "It's so easy to cash in these chips on my shoulders, so easy to lose this old tongue like a tiger. It's easy to let all this bitterness smolder, just to hide it away like a cigarette lighter." And I just want to, Peterson, if you're listening, it's a federal crime to read mail. You know, he's referencing scripture there with, you know, "loose this old tongue like a tiger." And he mixes that with some really neat imagery of, like, just to hide it away like a cigarette lighter, which I don't think cars even have cigarette lighters anymore. But they do just kind of stow away in the cars that had them, and you don't see that they're there. Go ahead.
So one of the things that the church that I worked for had was a tobacco covenant. And so there was a, we won't talk about that too much, but one of the jokes around there was a group of us who really liked cigars. Uh-huh. And me being the young cigar aficionado, if you will, it kind of became a joke that you got to keep that lighter hidden. Like when you're rifling around in your pockets and looking for that thing you were carrying, make sure not to pull it out in front of certain people. Cause that was a dead giveaway.
Yes. But you know, something like that, I appreciated that even if he was going to, bring out scripture and kind of speak quote unquote Christianese in some of his songs, viewed from that context, I found them really encouraging. And even just some of his imagery, just in general, like the song Planting Trees, using the idea of planting trees as a metaphor for growing your family and trying to raise your children and create a like an ethic in your family. I don't know, it was just really like it stuck with me and I noticed it.
I think there is a valuable message in just about every one of the songs on this album. We could dive into the lyrics like headlong and just have a fun time with it.
Absolutely.
For me, one of the songs I really wanted to bring up, and any of our listeners who's a dedicated like Christian music fan or whatever will know his song Dancing in the Minefields, even if they don't know who Andrew Peterson is, they'll recognize this song. It has been covered by just about everybody at this point.
It's probably been played at a ton of weddings, I imagine.
It was played at my wedding.
See, that's so terrible because I don't remember. I was there and I don't remember the song. That's so bad.
And I promised Tiffany I would mention that, you know, she asked me when I told her, oh, we're doing this Counting Stars album by Andrew Peterson. And she asked, is that the album that has Dancing in the Minefields? And I was like, no, because I forgot it was on this album.
Just with the confidence of a man.
Oh, yeah.
That I share, by the way.
About 6 hours later, I had to admit to her, oh, wait, yeah, it is. And he's released it on a couple other albums since then. This version of
interesting.
This version of it is a very kind of scaled back acoustic version. The version that was in my wedding 4 years later is a much more orchestral, you know, big sounding tune that he released two albums after this. But this is a song that I mentioned in the intro when we were talking about it. And it kind of leads me to my belief that he writes lyrics before music. He was interviewed for, I can't remember what the magazine was, but when he had just gotten married, he and his wife got into their first big blow up fight and they both went to bed angry. And, you know, that was, you know, their first big fight. And this song came out of that fight. It was something that he was doodling around in his journal. And, you know, why is this worth it? Why is this struggle and this pain worth it? And he came up with this song that, I mean, beautiful imagery throughout. One of the verses says, we got the rings for 40 each from a pawn shop down the road. We said our vows and took the leap now 15 years ago. And, you know, things like that are really cool. Lines, the chorus to it goes, and we went dancing in the minefields. We went sailing in the storms and it was harder than we dreamed, but I believe that's what the promise is for. And that song has meant a lot to me over the years, even since this, because that also has a lot to do with your faith journey, too. Life isn't just, you know, I became a Christian, got baptized, and things are all well and good. There are a lot of things that just come at you. And if you're not looking for it, it's going to hit you upside the head pretty hard. And not only does it apply to marriage, but it applies to the decision to have faith and not walk away from it and throw it away. So yeah. I've really felt a special place about this song, especially since we got married and I have that kind of in our wedding. So
he has a way of expressing things of faith that like some of it was like kind of familiar CCM ground.
Oh yeah.
But you know, there was definitely a lot more to it than the kind of music that you hear, you know, on Hey Love or what have you.
Well, and one thing I appreciate about this album now with the distance of time on it that I'd kind of not made the connection to, but you and I talking in preparation for this episode kind of flicked the light bulb on. I like that this is not trying to be something that it isn't in a lot of ways. I mean, it kind of treads some familiar ground or whatever, but I don't feel like he's preaching at me about, you know, a psalm or whatever, you know, trying to teach me any particular lesson in general. It's his reflections on those certain things and how he's perceiving them more so than, you know, the Bible says this and now you better believe it or else you're wrong. And a lot of Christian music comes across that way. It's trying hard to be so doctrinally relevant without actually doing it because it's just kind of lame.
Yeah. And without actually like adding in the things that make a song something that you want to listen to. You know, when the goal becomes, well, we have to teach this, you know, all the other things that make a song good kind of fall away. And there's a lot of personal stuff in this album that I really appreciated that I think set it apart in the way that you're talking about. The song You Came So Close, he examines marital infidelity, which is not a thing that you...
that's being done on stage at church.
Yeah, Stephen Curtis Chapman is not singing songs about it. And if he is, look, I don't care. Don't at me. But
the 80s called, they want Stephen back.
Oh, man, they can have him. One of the lines from that song in particular I liked because it was not... It wasn't doctrine, and it wasn't even a big moment in the song. But he says, he's talking about kind of where he was at, or the character in the song, or whoever was at, when they got to this point in their marriage where either they had committed infidelity or thought about it or what have you. He says, "And the sky in Nashville, it can bend you low, because the winter here is gray, without a trace of snow." You know, he's talking about where he's at as a person and how he personally, or whoever the song is about, feels about these gray skies and just kind of the dismal situation he finds himself in. And that's like a thing you look for in quote unquote secular music, you know, in regular music. And he's got a lot of lines in his music that sound like he is writing from his heart and from personal experience. And he's able to incorporate, you know, spiritual truths, but it, like you said, it doesn't feel like he's trying to hammer people over the head with it as much as it's a thing that he believes and that he's going to sing about. And I really appreciated that about this album.
Let's see, what else do you want to talk about this one before we move on?
Well, just before we move on to the reviews or whatever we're doing next, I do want to say there were a lot of fun musical styles and influences that were kind of peeking through the CCM curtain on this album. Dancing in the Minefields, some of it really reminded me of like late 80s Phil Collins with like big background vocals. I really loved that. Isle of Sky, I really enjoyed too. You know, we've kind of complained about short songs, but I thought this was a really effective short song. And I think a lot of that has to do with the music because it had this big sweeping orchestral score to it. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of Simon and Garfunkel, which I really liked. I'll just go ahead and spoil the surprise. My favorite song on this album was Fool with a Fancy Guitar. And like, I could picture in my head, James Taylor singing that song because it was just so like the guitar part was perfect. His voice like kind of strayed into that area a little bit. And so you can tell, like, at least I felt this way, that if he had been left to his own devices or had, you know, some rando producer from Columbia Records, which I'm sure they're not even around anymore, but, you know, insert famous record label here had produced this album, it might have been a little bit more musically rich and a little less, you know, kind of stylistically consistent to fit within the parameters of, you know, music that's going to be on Kalof.
So this album was produced primarily by Andrew Peterson and two of his closest collaborators, Ben Sheave. So
I'm straight up wrong.
I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong. Ben Sheave or Shiva or Shive. And then Andy Gullihorn, who are two other kind of alternative Christian musicians that Peterson was in a group with for a long time. Them and then a few other Christian musicians were a group called the Square Peg Alliance, and they were songwriters. They weren't a band, but they were a group of songwriters who got together and wrote music and kind of collaborated on different things over the years. And because of that group, Ben was a producer for the group Cademan's Call, who were really big in the late 90s in the Christian circle.
And I had a Cadman's Call CD. You better believe.
So Peterson ended up being their opening act for several years on tour. He just toured with them and was their opening act. And then he ended up touring with groups like, you know, Fernando Ortega, Michael Card, Sarah Groves, Bebo Norman, kind of the alternative subgenre of Christian music, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so this album has a lot of kind of those diverse perspectives on music. I wouldn't say that any of those guys are like the greatest ever or whatever, but they all draw from a very alternative style of music that mm-hmm. is not generally popular with, well, it has a lot more crossover appeal for general audiences, yes. if you will.
Yeah. And I don't know, I can't speak to how well Cadman's Call or Michael Card, because he's the other artist in that list you mm-hmm. Mentioned that I'm familiar with. But for both of those artists,
how are you not familiar with Sarah Groves? She is phenomenal.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't listen to Christian music.
Her voice is really on par with Alison Krauss.
Really?
And she has done. I need to give it a shot. She has done a lot of non-Christian music as well. So.
Well, I need to check it out then. But what I notice about the musicians that I do recognize is they are. Primarily acoustic, mm-hmm. but also seem a lot more concerned with the craft of songwriting,
yes.
and excellence in that field. And I realize I'm casting a lot of aspersions on probably a lot of music that people like, but I got to call it how I see it.
The Dove Awards aren't on TV anymore, so you can say whatever you want. It's not that many
good.
People.
Good. Yeah, I'm not worried about Toby Mac breaking down my door and laying the beat down on me. But yeah, man, I really did enjoy this album. I'm curious. So tell me a little bit about the critical reception, because you have quite a bit there in the show notes. And I'm curious how this was received.
All right, let's do it. You know, it's funny when I think of Andrew Peterson, the artist, I think of Christian music as being off the mainstream path. And within Christian music, being a small niche of the music world, Andrew Peterson's music seems to be like a totally different subgenre, even within there, that Christian alternative folk, whatever you want to call it. When I looked at how this album was reviewed and received, I was kind of stunned. There won't be reviewers that most of our listeners are familiar with, because we're looking at like Christianity Today and whatever, you know, the In Circle is for Christian music, but... this album did end up making the Billboard Top 200, topping out at number 123, and was on the list for 6 weeks. So it had some staying power, and it actually made a Billboard list for a while. Mm-hmm. John Hurst gave this a 4 out of 5 star review on Christianity Today, writing about Counting Stars, Peterson is just a humble folk singer. His music is tasteful and elegant and never flashy. And I thought that was a fairly fair review. Like, it's not over the top. And it's kind of funny, if you listen to other versions of Dancing in the Minefields, like I had mentioned, they get a lot flashier and a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. Bigger. So it's kind of funny.
The wedding oriented productions of it.
Yes, exactly. And then the magazine Cross Rhythms gave it a 10 out of 10, with Paul Kerslake recognizing that it's a folk oriented music and it can sometimes be a bit repetitive, but the combination of finely crafted songs and adept musicianship raises the album to the highest level. So those were the things that I saw. And I think it kind of falls in line with what you and I have been talking about throughout mm-hmm. this discussion.
Yeah. And before we move on to our reviews, I just want to mention something that I didn't before that Paul Kerslake mentioned. He did, the musicianship on this album is good. Like, even if the style is not 100% my jam, mm-hmm. You know, the instrumentation of each track was varied. This album, although it had a cohesive style that maybe I wasn't a huge fan of, the songs were distinct. I didn't ever find myself going like, oh, this is that song. I thought this was the other one. Like, yeah. It was good.
The same four bars in the chorus. Oh,
man, if there was a reason outside of my dissatisfaction with the way churches and musicians interact, like having to play the 1-4-6-5 for every stinking song.
Hey, it means you can play every song in their book day one.
Yes, I know. And it drove me nuts, but I need to get off my high horse about that. What say we give our reviews here?
Absolutely, Chris. And I'm going to put you right back on your high horse. We use a 1-6 guitar string review model, 1 being an absolutely terrible album and 6 being the greatest thing ever created. Chris, preach to me about what you thought about this album.
Well, I don't know that I have much of a sermon to preach. So I had a mixed experience with this album. I'm not really a fan of most Christian music because of the two flaws, one of which we kind of mentioned. I just feel like Christian music is sort of beset by a paralyzing addiction to making inoffensive and relatable music. And also, like, unlike Peterson's music, a lot of Christian music has this just inability to write personal songs. There's a lot of songs out there with just sort of ham-fisted lines of scripture and doctrine crammed into them. And I don't want to adjudicate that whole issue, but I think those flaws really kneecap a lot of Christian artists who might otherwise be making great art. But I think that this album is not quite as handicapped by those things as a lot of Christian music is. I found myself a little frustrated that every aspect of this album that I liked had a caveat, because there were occasional moments where the Christianese verses of the song kind of crept in and interrupted. But part of that is also a personal issue. You know, you have to come at music at least being willing to kind of meet it halfway in its context. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of music has a historical context, a personal context, you know, the purpose for which it was written. So, yeah, and you know, to be honest with y'all, the review that I wrote is a little bit more critical than our conversation was, because I found, as Wood and I talked about this, that I really did enjoy this album. And so I think I need to make a distinction between the rating that I give the artist's quality and my experience of it. I think that I probably had like a 4 out of 6 string experience. It was really a great album, but maybe not necessarily right up my alley. But I think that especially if you're a Christian, Andrew Peterson is a 6-string artist. He's approaching his lyrical material and the music from a point of integrity that I think maybe a lot of other Christian artists don't necessarily. And so I think for me, the final word on it is it was a really strong 4 out of 6 strings.
Very good, man.
So now you have to get on your pulpit and preach a little bit. How was it to revisit Counting Stars for you?
So my review is kind of all over the place, and I'm just going to kind of wing it as I'm thinking here, and we'll cut it down to make it sound plausible.
Do it. Nobody's paying for this, so.
You get what you pay for, or is it exactly. You get what you deserve?
yeah, both of those.
You know, they say once you look behind the curtain, the power of Oz is just a little bit different. You know, it's not quite the same, and you can't put that genie back in the bottle. And for me, with my early experience with disappointment in people not measuring up to what I figured the ideal, you know, Christian experience should be, I walked away from that really hurt. And it's something that, you know, Tiffany and I have struggled with over the years. I'm still a diehard Christian. I love Jesus, but I have a lot of issues with the church, air quotes around the church. And because of that, we've had some struggles over the years with finding a place that we could call home, because I see what's going on at a church and just sitting in the pews and go, oh, I know what's going on here. I know what that is. I've got a feeling for how this all works, and it kind of poisons the experience. And I have to think back to albums like this, to things that recenter me on what's really important, what is the matter. You know, I need to be a good example of what I expect of the church. I need to be the church to other people. And I need things like this to help ground me. When we pulled this album out of the hat, when the Oracle gave it to us and I started listening to it, the first few times that I listened to it, I had a lot of emotions that I had not realized that I still had pent up about this. And it took me a lot of time to think through, how do I want to tell this story? How do I want this to come across? And will I even be able to? I got pretty emotional the first night after this, like, oh, I don't think I can talk about this. Like, this is still way too raw for something that happened 12 and a half years ago at this point. And this album was one of those things that helped bring me out of that dark place. When I think about, you know, what we are called to be as the church and what we are, you know, trying to emulate as people being followers of Christ, there are a lot of things that I'm not necessarily proud of, and there are a lot of things that I am proud of. And I think listening to this album through the lens of 10 or 12 more years of life experience has kind of reinvigorated that in me all these years later. There's a lot of very powerful lyrics, like we've said, that still connect with me in ways that I didn't realize they would. And listening to it now through the lens of being married for 7 years to my best friend in the whole wide world, shout out to Tiffany. There's nothing that I don't really love about this album. There are things that kind of bug me, and like you had mentioned, the ham-fisted doctrine. There are a couple of lines in this that is like, oh, really? We had to go there? Like, I was having a good time. But all of that said, this album and a couple of other things around it have been key to my growth, both as a Christian and as a man. It helped me recalibrate who I wanted to be when I grew up, quote unquote. And here I am looking down the path of those decisions 10 years later, and I'm pretty proud of what it has allowed me to do. Ultimately, it changed my trajectory, changed my career path, my degree path, and I ended up meeting Tiffany as a result of that. And because of that, this album, kind of as that branching point, really means a lot to me. So all of that said, I think Andrew Peterson's musicality, the way he uses his voice, the way he writes music in general, the way he writes lyrics, are just phenomenal. I think he's underutilized and underrecognized in the world of music in general, not just in the Christian music world. It is a niche market with a very niche subgenre within that kind of makes him inaccessible to some people, but hopefully somebody figures it out and gets on that train as a result of our conversation. I felt like this album was perfect. I felt like it's perfect for me, and it's perfect for what I needed it to be in the moment. And because of that, I'm giving it 6 out of 6. You can fight me.
Nah, I'm not going to fight you. Yeah, this album was excellent. And, you know, if I can tack on like a little
addendum,
whatever the opposite of a prologue is, a postlogue,
epilogue.
There we go. I promise I went to college. You know, this album had a profound impact on your life. And I think that is due in no small part to its quality. Bad art does not penetrate the heart or mind.
Looking at you, Picasso.
And what I'm trying to say is the medium is the message. Mm-hmm. And so if there are any Christian musicians listening to this, worry first about making good art instead of is this, you know, is this going to fit on a Christmas card or a tract? You know what I'm saying? Like, good music and good art is what is going to change people's lives. I mean, ultimately, it's Christ working through those things. But if you want people to pay attention, and if you want to say something meaningful, you have to start from a place of honesty and integrity artistically, instead of trying to fit everything into a doctrinal box. Because I think if you really believe those things, they will be in there. And I think as Christian artists, it's important to trust that instead of coming at it the other way around. Hopefully I didn't just like cause everybody to turn their podcast device off.
Well, but to throw it way back to the ancient Greeks, to thine own self be true, right from the heart, and be who you are, and let it happen. Because, you know, focusing on the quality of what you're doing more so than the accessibility, I think, is key there.
Yeah. And I mean, we could do an entire podcast on how many problems I have with Christian movies and music, but we won't do that. Instead, what we should do is move on to favorite and least favorite tracks.
All right, Chris. Well, what was your favorite track?
So I already brought it up, so I don't want to bore people. But man, I really did love Fool with a Fancy Guitar. It was very personally relatable to me. As I was working on the show notes for this and listening to that song one of these mornings here last week, I teared up and had to sit and like gather myself, just because, like, me personally right now, I'm going through some like frustrations and resentments and trying to work through some of that and not get to the point where I am like this bitter, unhappy person. Mm-hmm. And so the message in that song about, you know, being able to seek Christ in the way that we are, that he sees past our foolishness to who we are, was really moving. And also, man, the song is in the time signature of 6/8 to go completely left turn into music world. And a lot of musicians I talk to love that time signature. I'm not sure why, but man, I was a sucker for the whole feel and vibe of that song. It was just really good. What about you? What was your absolute favorite track?
So I've liked every track on this album for different reasons. And I say that every week or whatever, but when it's one of my albums, originally my favorite track for this album, and it's even in the show notes here, was You Came So Close. That was the track that really, the first time I sat down and listened to this album back in 2010. And that was, you know, for the first bunch of songs, they're great, whatever. But You Came So Close is the one that hooked me and got me to really pay attention to this album. And it's kind of interesting. I've had a lot of trouble with some of your groups here in the recent past with them being depressing or whatever. And
that's fair.
This song,
that's totally fair.
This song is by far and away the most depressing song on this entire album.
It's heavy.
It's a rough song to listen to. And I've told you that, you know, the reason I didn't like those other albums was because it puts me in a dark place and it keeps me there. And this song definitely puts you in a dark place and it keeps you there. But that was for a long time. What if you had told me on Counting Stars, what's your favorite? That would have been my gut answer.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I'm kind of excited the fact that Dancing in the Minefields is on this album, because my gut answer was You Came So Close as the song that had the most impact on me. But Dancing in the Minefields was in our wedding. Dancing in the Minefields is a beautiful story about commitment. And now that I've been married for, you know, seven years, I love that song for more and more reasons every day. And I would be remiss to say that's not my favorite, because it is the one that I would come to the most often.
Yeah. I don't know if you recall, but when we did the City in Color album, I had that same predicament where I was like, wait, What if I don't say that the song that played on my wedding wasn't my favorite tune? What do I do?
So while we were recording already, or a little bit earlier, I was looking ahead in the show notes, kind of wrapping my mind around what I needed to say next. I was like, do I stick with this? And then I was like, no, you know what? This is how I actually feel.
Yeah.
Time has changed and I've moved on, and Dancing in the Minefields is the tune, man.
Absolutely. So, that's great.
That said, my least favorite song has been the same for forever, and I want to hear what yours is so we can compare notes.
So my least favorite track on this album was The Reckoning, and in parentheses, How Long. And much like our episode about Metallica, I think that this has more to do with my personal hangups than the objective quality of the song. You know, that song is all about the end of days and the return of Christ and that kind of thing. And I think that some of us Christians kind of miss the forest for the trees when we just obsess about the end times or whatever you want to call that. And so I just felt like Peterson kind of tiptoed up to that line of like, oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. I can't wait. And I think that it ignores a lot of our call to be a force for change in the world that we live in now. Mm-hmm. And so it felt a little bit to me, and maybe not even in the song itself, but maybe it just reminded me a lot of people and experiences that I've had. But I did appreciate that at the end of the song, he drops the line, and I know that I don't know what I'm asking. In the song, he talks a lot about, you know, like, when are you going to come back?
How long until, how long until, how long until?
Yeah. Like, yeah. So I think that at least he makes kind of an interesting admission of like, well, I probably don't even understand the implications of that. So that was my least favorite song. What was yours?
So my least favorite song is The Reckoning. For some of the same reasons, I see it as kind of a two-level deep song. It's not just about the end of times, but also kind of looking forward to the mortality of the self and the fact that at some point in time, you and I will have our moment of judgment. And it's kind of looking at it from that lens too, from the personal sphere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the song is well written. I think the music is pretty decent for it. It's subjectively, at least in my experience, it is my least favorite song musically on the album. It's the one I would skip just for the music. It kind of, you know, to go back and be honest about Andrew Peterson's voice, this is the song that sounds the most whiny in his voice. Just like, really, like, punch it up a little bit, be a little bit stronger, whatever. I don't know what the right word is, but don't sing through your nose on this particular one. I think this song does have something beneficial to offer, regardless of how you feel about premillennialism or postmillennialism or amillennialism, for those of you who are into, you know, really
deep in the theology weeds.
Exactly. But as far as just being a song that I want to come listen to all the time, it's not one that would be on repeat or would be one that I'm interested in. So,
yeah,
you know, that's that. It's not the best song on the album.
All right. Well, do you want to head over to the Oracle's kitchen and ask her to bend a spoon?
You know,
get a cookie.
I rewatched that movie and I feel like she's using an Otis Spunkmeyer oven and not just like a crappy, like, home, like, toaster oven. But whatever, those cookies are still good. You won't see me turn down a cookie.
I would be more impressed with the whole spoons bending thing. It doesn't matter what the cookies are at that point.
They're still warm.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see what we get. So Chris, we're picking from your list and, it is our second foray into jazz music. Number 18, 1959's Mingus Ah-Um.
All right. The Oracle is in the mood for jazz. We just did Herbie Hancock a few episodes ago. So I'm going to keep that train a rolling. The A train. Yeah, we can take the A train.
Well, I'm excited, man. I am not familiar with Charles Mingus's work at all. So this will be a whole new experience for me.
It's a trip. It'll be good. I think you will be entertained, if nothing else.
Awesome, man. Well, folks, thank you so much for listening this week to Two Dudes and Tunes. If you're enjoying our show, please rate and review it on your podcasting platform of choice. We look forward to reading those reviews and incorporating them into the show at some point in time. Chris, take it away.
Absolutely. If you want to get in touch with us, go ahead and shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. And don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. Let us know what you thought of Counting Stars and today's episode. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday, where we get a swing in our step, chomp on our cigars, and learn exactly how mad you have to be to destroy a 5-digit instrument. Y'all take care.